Let's Get You a White Coat is brought to you by King County Medical Society. You can find them online at kcmsociety.org. Thank you for listening. In light of a recent tragedy in this country involving guns, today we are sitting down with the director of the Firearm Injury and Policy Research Program in the Harborview Injury Prevention and Research Center at the University of Washington. Our guest has conducted firearms-related research since 1987 and is a decorated pediatric doctor. We are fortunate today to have Dr. Frederick Rivara join us. To sort of start, people are looking for change when it comes to gun laws, and that along with almost any other issue involves kind of understanding what has been set in place prior to that process. Dr. Rivara, can you paint us a picture as to kind of how we got into the situation that we're currently in?
Well, the fact is that the federal government has really done very little in recent years to restrict access to firearms for those who might harm themselves or others. The action has really been at the state level. We now have an estimated 400 million firearms in the United States, and firearm sales went up fairly dramatically during that pandemic and during 2021 for a variety of reasons. I think that people were concerned about their own safety, and then primary reasons that people own firearms is because of self-protection. So we have a situation where we have a massive number of firearms in the United States. And we have a Second Amendment that has been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court as allowing individuals to own firearms. So those are givens right now in the United States, which we have to start from. I think that the other thing is, since the federal government has not done very much in the last half century for firearms, the states have taken this on themselves. And so there's basically 50 different experiments in the states across the country for how to regulate access to firearms. And Washington is quite different from Texas, where the latest firearm school shooting happened. Washington had made great advances in the last few years in terms of passing some common sense gun policies. We now have universal background checks, which is the idea that wherever you buy a firearm, whether it be from a licensed federal firearms dealer, or whether it be from a gun show or an individual private sales, individual has to undergo a background check. This is something that we believe is very important. Texas does not have that universal background check law, nor is there present in the United States as a whole. Another recent change here in the state of Washington is the ability to limit sales of assault rifles, semi-automatic assault rifles like this young man used in Texas, only to individuals 21 years of age or over. This was passed after there was a shooting in Mukilteo, where an individual who I believe is 19 years of age, who's less than 21, went to buy a firearm because he wanted to shoot some individuals he knew. He went to a store, and because he was less than 21, he could not buy a handgun, but he could buy a semi-automatic rifle. So he was sold a semi-automatic rifle and used that to kill friends. As a result of that shooting in Mukilteo, we now have a law that you have to be 21 to both to buy a handgun and to buy a semi-automatic rifle. Clearly in Texas, that's not the case. This individual in Texas at age 18 was able to buy two semi-automatic rifles. We have, just this past year, the legislature passed a limit on high-capacity magazines to 10 rounds. This is important because under circumstances of a mass shooting, the shooter has to change magazines to continue to shoot. And if they are using a magazine that says 100 rounds or 30 rounds, they can shoot a lot more people before they have to change magazines. So that's another thing that doesn't exist in the state of Texas. We also have here in the state of Washington something called the Extreme Risk Protection Order, or a red flag law. And this exists now in 19 states, which allows a family member or someone who shares a household or a child with an individual who, if they're concerned that the individual has firearms and their behavior indicates they might be at risk of harming themselves or other, that person can go to a court and ask that the firearms be removed from the individual. This is a judicial process where the individual can only have their firearms removed by the order of a judge, It's not a permanent order. It lasts for up to a year, and it doesn't really violate a person's Second Amendment rights. 19 states have this. Texas is not one of those 19 states. State of Washington has something called the Do Not Sell Law. It's one of the few states in the country that have this, which is a law where an individual say I'm depressed and I'm worried that in the future I might try to go buy a gun and commit suicide. I can go down to the county clerk's office and list myself as to be on this Do Not Sell list. So then when I go to try to buy a gun in the future, that won't be sold to me. So it protects me as an individual from committing suicide by buying a firearm. It's, again, a voluntary thing that protects a person's Second Amendment rights. We're one of a few states that have that. So there have been a variety of things here in this state that don't exist in the state of Texas that have made our state, I believe, safer for the citizens in the state.
I want to jump to a little bit larger of a federal scale and talk and kind of begin to transition a little bit more into sort of your legacy work you've been doing. Research into firearms since, I believe, 1987. And I want to begin to sort of talk about the research you put forward that was backed by the CDC, which prompted a response from the NRA.
So I worked, starting back in 1987, I worked with Dr. Arthur Kellerman, who at that time was at the University of Tennessee, then Emory University. And we did a series of studies here in Seattle and Memphis that looked at the relationship between homeownership of firearms and risk of suicide and homicide occurring in the home. And what we showed is that homes that had firearms had a 3 to 5-fold increased risk of having a homicide or suicide in the home. And those studies were funded by the Centers for Disease Control. They were all published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which everyone agrees is probably the most prestigious medical journal in the world. Our colleagues thought they were terrific studies. The NRA did not like them for obvious reasons. And the NRA ended up lobbying Congress. They threatened to cut off all the CDC funding for injury research. They ended up cutting the CDC funding by the amount that was spent on firearm injury research. And they passed something called the Dickey Amendment, which was an amendment named after Jay Dickey, who was a congressman, that basically said no federal money could be used for lobbying against firearms. Now, we didn't do any lobbying about firearms policy or firearm laws. None of our money was used for that. But the way it was interpreted is that the CDC did not fund any more firearm research for the next 20-plus years. This was passed in 1996. It was really only until a couple of years ago that the CDC again started funding firearm research. So there was a really marked deficit in terms of firearm research for a period of 20-plus years in the United States. Why is that important? Well, it's important because we need to know who's at greatest risk of being shot, who's at greatest risk of perpetrating firearm crimes, and which interventions work, which firearm laws work, which ones don't work. So it was really a devastating effect upon the research into this area for many, many years.
In your expertise, what are steps that would take us towards a positive shift on gun legislation? And what would those look like on a state and federal level?
Well, I think let's take it even further down to an individual level. I'm a physician, and I know we're speaking here to a number of physicians. And I think that it's important that physicians realize this is something that's partly their responsibility in their everyday doctor-patient interactions. I think that particularly if they have a depressed patient in their office or a family member who has cognitive impairments, they need to ask about, are there firearms in the home? And if so, how are the firearms stored? Are they stored safely? So we know that 30% or so of homes in the state of Washington and across the country have firearms in them. And we know that if you store firearms safely, it certainly reduces the risk of children getting access to firearms and accidentally shooting one, like happened a couple of weeks ago down in Federal Way. It reduces the risk of adolescent suicide. It reduces the risk of adolescents obtaining firearms inappropriately. And it reduces the risk of theft. And we know that about a third of crime guns are obtained by theft. So safe storage of firearms is really important. Now, we as physicians do have the ability and legal right to ask patients about firearms. There was a law passed a number of years ago in Florida, which basically tried to prevent physicians from asking about firearms. And it went back and forth through the court for a number of years, but finally it was thrown out by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Florida, who said that it violated the physician's First Amendment rights. It violated the physician's First Amendment rights by having such a law, and physicians are able, without any sort of penalty, to ask about firearms, because I think it's important they do so for under certain circumstances. Secondly, I think that physicians need to realize that, well, they can't file an extremist protection order. They can counsel the family about filing an extremist protection order if they feel like there's a family member who is at risk of harming themselves or others because they're going through a crisis and they own firearms. So that's something I think that physicians really need to know about. Third, we have to realize that in the state of Washington, 75% of the firearm deaths are suicides. Nationally, it's 60%. And in most of the Western states, the vast majority of firearm deaths are actually suicides. So we need to understand that trying to pick up individuals who are at risk of harm, harming themselves, and making sure that we ask about firearm ownership and access to those firearms. We have set up a website where individuals can go and look at places where they can temporarily store firearms outside the home. So if you have, for example, a middle-aged man who is a firearm owner who is going through crisis, trying to safely store it in a home might not be feasible. But storing it temporarily outside the home in a police station or a shooting range or a firearm retail outlet is feasible, and we have provided information about how they can go about doing that. So these are ways that we as physicians can help patients to be safe. I think that we have to realize that at the state level is where action is happening for appropriate restrictions on access to firearms. And I'm not saying getting rid of firearms by any means. We're not trying to overturn the Second Amendment, really trying to protect the citizens of the state. So I think that all of us need to understand the issues, be acquainted with the issues, speak to our legislators about the issues, and let them know how we believe. At the federal level, you know, Senator Murray made a speech on the Senate floor on Wednesday. It was very impassioned and talked about how Congress has repeatedly failed to protect the American public from common sense safety measures. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand is that most people in this country, the vast majority of people in this country, want common sense firearm measures. And the Congress has not failed to do anything. When current President Biden was vice president in 2012 after the Newtown shooting, President Obama asked President Biden to try to work on the problem, and unfortunately, he was unsuccessful. There are limits to what can be done by executive order. President Obama did a number of executive orders, but there's real limits to that. We know that a presidential executive order can be overturned by the next president. So I think that it's really up to our legislators to do what we think is appropriate and to pass some common sense firearm legislation, like, for example, a universal background check, like a universal extreme risk protection order across the country. Texas, as I mentioned earlier, had none of these common sense laws, and I think Texas is now seeing the result of that. And I think Texas needs to realize that the fault of it lies with Governor Abbott and the legislators there.
As we wrap up our conversation here, do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share?
When you have sort of a mass shooting like this, it really affects the national psyche. And all of us, to some degree, are suffering from PTSD. All of us are suffering from this tragic event to see these young children die. After one of these mass shootings, I think it was after the Las Vegas shooting, the physician spoke out about the problem. And the NRA told physicians, stay in your lane. Well, this is our lane. Physicians are the ones taking care of these victims in the emergency departments in the operating room. Physicians are the one trying to counsel families after the loss of a loved one. So this really is the physician's lane. And I think it's our responsibility to be knowledgeable about what we can do with an individual patient as well as in our communities to try to keep us all safe. I think, though, it's important to realize that last year in the United States, about 45,000 people were killed by firearms. Mass shootings make up a very small percentage of that. And we're talking about, you know, 100 and 150 people each day, day in and day out, dying from firearms. And so we have to really remember that this is a problem that, while it makes the news now because of this terrible situation that happened in Texas. It happens every day in communities across our country. And it also happens much more likely to vulnerable individuals, individuals who are poor or minorities. And, you know, it happens to people who are mentally ill. Mentally ill people are much, much more likely to be victims of violence than to be perpetrators of violence. And to blame the problem on mental illness is really missing the point. Mentally ill people are not the problem here. All of us would agree that our mental health systems are not functioning very well. They need to be fixed. They need more resources. I'm a pediatrician, and for me to find a mental health counselor for an adolescent here in our city is tough. All of us agree that that needs to be fixed. But by talking about mental health right now, it's diverting the attention from the real problem, which is the ability for many, many people in this country to have unfettered access to firearms. I think it's also for us to be active in our professional organizations, whether it's the King County Medical Association or the Washington State Medical Association, or, for example, the American College of Surgeons, American Academy of Pediatrics, Emergency College of Emergency Physicians. They all have taken very strong stances about safe firearm safety and about sensible firearm laws. And I think we need to support those associations, make our attitudes known towards them so that they can continue to act on our behalf at a national level. But let's not buy the NRA argument that it's a mental illness problem. It's a firearm problem.
And thank you so much for listening to Let's Get You a White Coat. This show is put together by King County Medical Society. King County Medical Society is an organization by physicians for physicians. So if you're a practicing physician or still practicing to be a physician, connect with us online at kcmsociety.org. If you enjoy the show, please give us a follow on your podcatcher of choice and leave us a 5-star rating. Again, thank you so much for listening and supporting community-dedicated doctors. We'll see you next time.